Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
How did life begin? For thousands of years, people believed in spontaneous generation, organisms arising from non-life without progenitor or seed. But support for spontaneous generation has slowly retreated to its final stronghold, spontaneous formation of the first living organism. Yet what does the latest science say about the prospects for purely natural processes bringing about life? I'm Eric Anderson, and joining me today for part two of our conversation is Dr. Robert Stadler, co-author of a recently published book, The Stairway to Life, An Origin of Life Reality Check. Dr. Stadler received training in electrical engineering and medical engineering at Case Western Reserve University, MIT, and Harvard. He has obtained more than 140 patents, has been elected Fellow of the American Institute of Medical and Biomedical Engineers, and has contributed to medical devices that are used by millions of patients worldwide. Welcome back, Rob.
Thank you, Eric. It's good to be here today.
Rob, in our last conversation, we talked about some of the challenges that must be overcome for natural processes to advance from simple chemicals to a living cell. And then we also discussed what you called the final stronghold of belief in spontaneous generation, meaning back to the origin of life, the first life. The back cover of your book says that the stairway to life is a thought-provoking inquiry that breaches this final stronghold of spontaneous generation. There have been a lot of books in recent years discussing problems with the origin of life. Can you bring our listeners up to speed on the unique way your book approaches the origin of life debate?
Sure. Our book, it lays out the requirements for natural processes to bridge the gap from chemistry, that is simple molecules, to get to biology or a living cell that can reproduce itself. And so using the metaphor of a stairway, we lay out these requirements and then we review the steps one by one. And I think a unique approach here is that with each new step that we talk about, we begin by assuming that the prior steps have all been accomplished by natural processes. So we'll give you all the prior steps. Now let's talk about this next one. And then we find out that the next required step on its own cannot be achieved through natural processes. So the 12 steps that we highlight are actually 12 impossibilities for natural processes. And altogether, we take them as a whole, they clarify the kind of leap of faith that is required to believe that first life got started by natural processes.
Right.
I think the book also highlights some challenges that may be overlooked by other books, like the required mechanisms to repair biopolymers that we talked about last time, and the required perfectly consistent linkage of the monomers in order to form biopolymers like DNA and proteins. And the last step in the book is called coordinated cellular purpose.
What's this last step? I'm interested in this coordinated cellular purpose. I think you guys called this in your book the greatest challenge for materialistic explanation. What is this and why can't it be achieved by natural processes?
Yeah, the coordinated purpose of a cell is actually the highest level of organization. It's something that is inherited from the parent cell. It's not something you can find in molecules. So if you do a little thought experiment, if you consider taking billions of bacteria and you thoroughly scramble them in a blender, place the results in a petri dish. And by scrambled, I mean that all of the biomolecules are still intact, but they're randomly mixed, so they don't have their natural association or organization that you have in a living cell, but they're all there. So all the necessary ingredients for life are in that petri dish. But if you sit back and watch, life will never form. And that's because life is all about coordinated activity. You could use the metaphor of an orchestra, you know, with each component doing its part in a coordinated effort, pulling together in the same direction. So for cells, they have to pull together toward growth, toward obtaining food, toward getting rid of waste, toward reproducing. All happens in a coordinated effort. But in that petri dish with the scrambled components, and that's kind of like having an orchestra with no conductor and with everybody having a different sheet of music and keeping their own time, and you end up with chaos. You certainly don't end up with life.
So this is a really interesting point that I think our listeners need to understand, because what you're proposing, or what you're observing, I guess, is that we can have all of the components required for, say, a bacterium in you know, in the petri dish, and yet they will not come together to form that bacterium. There's something missing in the organization of that. I've heard one author describe this as the Humpty Dumpty problem. Humpty Dumpty breaks. It's not going to get back together again on its own. It requires this orchestration, as you call it.
Right. Not in a billion years.
So one of the required steps on your stairway is also selectively permeable membranes. What would you say to someone who claims that simply placing some phospholipids in water causes the spontaneous formation of the lipid bilayers of cell membranes?
Yeah, I hear this so often. You'll see it in all kinds of videos on origin of life. It's true that if you take phospholipids under the right conditions in water, they will form a lipid bilayer. And they'll say that's exactly like that found in cells.
Yeah, and just real quickly, Rob, for our listeners, what do we mean by a lipid bilayer for those who might not be familiar?
Well, a big component of membranes are phospholipids, and one side of the phospholipid likes to be in the presence of water and one side doesn't. Mm-hmm. You put them in water, they just naturally line up so that the parts that don't like water are facing each other, and the parts that do like water are facing outward toward the water. It makes a bilayer, two layers, like two sheets of paper.
Yeah, and then it folds up to kind of form a little bubble, right? Which, you know, if you look at it sideways and stick your tongue out and close one eye, it kind of looks like a cell, you know, cell membrane, right?
Yeah, and it can give you that kind of feeling from a high level that looks like a cell, but the problem is it really is nothing like that in a living mm-hmm. cell, because in a living cell you have to have compartmentalization, and that you do get from such a simple bilayer. But you also need what's called homeostasis, which means that the inside components of the cell are distinctly different than the outside of the cell. And the cell has to work to maintain this homeostasis so that it pulls in stuff against concentration gradients and it spits out waste. Mm. And it's actively moving stuff around so that it maintains an inner environment that's quite different than the outer environment. And what does that is a large component of proteins. If you take a cell membrane, just the membrane itself, you'll find that about half of the weight of the membrane is actually proteins, not all phospholipids. And these are not just simple proteins, you know, scattered about to provide structural stability or something. They're active molecular machines that are in there pulling stuff in that needs to come in and spitting stuff out that needs to get out of the cell. So even in the simplest cell known to man, the Mycoplasma genitalium, it has 140 different proteins it produces that exist, that operate in the cell membrane as part of the cell membrane. So membranes are anything but simple. And to have life, they have to be extremely complex. And so it's a bit of a bait and switch that you hear when people say that phospholipids alone practically form a cell.
Right, right. And I'm really bothered by this term that's used all the time, protocell, as though it's meaningful, as though it refers to something that actually is on its way to becoming a cell when it's, as you mentioned, it's just got nothing to do with it. Totally different system.
It's a kind of an imaginary entity, yes.
Yeah. So the media is consistently turning out these positive messages about the naturalistic origin of life. We constantly hear stories about the prebiotic soup or the natural formation of cellular components or these protocells, like you mentioned, RNA, cell membranes. We hear about searches for life on other planets, or if we find water on another planet, that maybe that practically guarantees, right, that we'll find life there. What do you think is driving all this misdirected encouragement for a naturalistic origin of life?
And there is indeed a lot of encouragement out there. Well, you know, science is about, fundamentally, it's about understanding natural laws. And when you apply science to understand a natural phenomenon, we tend to start by assuming that there is a natural explanation. And I can tell you in my research, I work on heart failure research, I do the same thing. I don't start to approach heart failure with a non-natural approach. I assume it's some natural phenomenon there. And that assumption of assuming a natural explanation is kind of baked into the methods of science these days, and it has a fancy name called methodological naturalism. Mm-hmm. And this is something that served us well in science for over 100 years, and a lot of good has come from it. But the problem comes when you try to apply science to something like origins of life or origin of the universe, And if you apply science under methodological naturalism, that means you're assuming that only a natural cause can be considered. And you actually run into a bit of a trap here, because if it's true, if you can just imagine it's true that natural causes could not have done it, that you need some agency, some intelligence that goes beyond natural causes in order to start life. You see, the way that they've defined science will blind you from being able to see that. In other words, science will lead us away from the truth, if that's the situation. And who wants, you know, a method of approaching truth that can actually lead us away from the truth?
Right. And so the question, I think, for all of us is, do I want the truth or do I want a naturalistic answer? Right. I mean, that's the question in front of us. And we have to sort of decide where we're going to make our stand.
Yeah. And science, when it's defined this way, actually is not pursuing truth. It's just pursuing the best naturalistic answer we can come up with.
Yeah. Right. Right. So what alternative would you propose to methodological naturalism?
Yeah, I really think that's a kind of simple thing. It basically, just be open to follow the data wherever it leads. Mm-hmm. And science, by providing a clear understanding of natural laws, it also helps us to know what natural processes cannot do. And so we know enough now about chemistry and physics and thermodynamics to know that life can't get started through natural processes. It's a lot like last time we mentioned perpetual motion machines. People used to think, maybe I can build a perpetual motion machine. Well, now we know enough because of science. We know enough about natural laws to know what they can't do, and they can't allow a perpetual motion machine.
Right.
It's not a natural thing. And I think the same is true for the start of life.
So you're not saying that we shouldn't approach a naturalistic answer for the origin of life. What you're saying is we've done that, and we've learned something profound about the limits of the natural processes. And on the other hand, there's probably also things we've learned about what intelligence can do or what an agent can do. And now that we've done that exercise, we have a reasonable conclusion that we can draw, right?
Yeah, we have learned a lot, and we understand the bounds of what natural processes can accomplish, and it makes it rather clear.
Yeah, and so this kind of leads into my next question I wanted to ask you about, because, you know, just to play devil's advocate, somebody might say, hey, your book is giving up on science. This is just a God of gaps argument. We don't know how life started, therefore God did it. How would you respond to that kind of criticism?
I think that's the criticism I hear the most often is people resort to say, this is God of the gaps and you're giving up on science. So first of all, to clarify that what this gap is, the gap is not just some little missing component for origin of life. It's essentially the entirety of the process of the origin of life. You know, the book covers 12 required steps, and laboratory efforts have not come close to demonstrating any of those 12 steps, you know, can happen from natural processes. And this gap is growing larger over time because we keep learning more and more about the minimal complexity of a living organism. Mm-hmm. So Craig Venter, he actually is working toward creating the minimal living organism by knocking out parts of organisms. And he wrote a paper with an organism that has 493 genes, but he found that 20% of those genes, which are all required to survive, 20% of them, they have no idea what they're doing, what those genes are doing. And so there's a lot of layers of the onion we haven't peeled back yet, and we're going to find more than these 12 required steps to get to life. And so finally, the book does not argue that no one knows how life began and therefore God did it. Rather, the inference for the need for intelligence in the origin of life flows from what we do know about physics and thermodynamics and biology. It comes from what we do know, not from what we don't know. And I'd like to turn that objection around to God of the gaps and turn it around to call something that what I would call materialism of the gaps, which is what I often hear from the other side is, you know, we don't know how natural processes actually started life, but we certainly know that it was a natural process. So just believe that it's a natural process. That's kind of a materialism of the gaps, using a materialistic belief to fill in the gap.
Right. That's the only answer we'll accept. And I think the point you made is really critical for our listeners to understand. I mean, after Stanley Miller back in the 1950s, there was a thought that, hey, we're going to have life built in the lab imminently, I think one researcher said. And it's not as though we have come closer in the last several decades to a naturalistic origin of life. As you mentioned, we're actually getting farther and farther away from a naturalistic answer the more we learn about what's required for, you know, a minimal cell, and what you guys go through in your book as to these 12 steps to get just basic life started.
Yeah, and it's been 68 years of research since Miller and Urey experiment. And if you look at what has been accomplished and compare it to any other field of technology, you know, computers or medicine or automobiles, transportation,
right,
the progress is just vanishingly small, if anything, for the origin of life group in the last 60.
Exactly.
Years.
And arguably even backwards in some sense, at least the perception. I mean, we obviously know a lot more about it, right? But the perception of how close we are to a naturalistic origin, I think, is a lot more sobering today than it was during the heady days after Miller-Urey.
And that is a message that needs to be heard.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for writing this book. This is fantastic. And I appreciate, Rob, you being with us for these two episodes of ID the Future to talk about this important topic of origin of life.
Thank you, Eric. It's been a pleasure.
Get your copy of The Stairway to Life, an Origin of Life Reality Check, in paperback or ebook format at online retailers like Amazon and Barnes & Noble. As always, join us for more episodes of ID the Future at idthefuture.com or your favorite podcast app. If you found our discussion today to be a valuable contribution to the public conversation about origins, please also consider helping us spread the word by giving the show a 5-star review on your podcast app of choice. For ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.